train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers humming. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord. Welcome to the Ferguson Response Network podcast. This is the first in our Ferguson Response Interviews podcast series. We're going to be splitting our weekly podcast to a bi-weekly podcast, one which will cover mostly news and topical information, and ones like this where we delve deep into some more high-minded and deeper discussions about issues related to Black liberation, white supremacy, and the fight for freedom. Both globally and here in the United States. My name is Leslie Mack, and I'm joined as always by my co-host Ricky L. Hines II. If you have never heard our show before, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Ferguson Response Network, and you can find us on our website at fergusonresponse.org. We're also featured in the AUA Movement app, which you can find on Google Play or on any Android device. And if you are looking for actions in your area, you can just go to fergusonresponse.tumblr.com, which will list Black Lives Matter actions in your area. And you can also choose to add any actions that you have coming up that you want to share with everyone else. Today, the topic of our show, we're going to be discussing white supremacy and anti-Blackness in museum and public education spaces. And we have two really amazing guests. So let's get to the show. And welcome back to Ferguson Response Network. Again, I'm your host, Leslie Mack. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Ricky Hines. And we have two really special guests with us tonight. We have Aaliyah Brown, who is a doctoral candidate and visiting scholar at the Michigan State University Museum. Prior to starting her PhD, she was a curator at the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center, and she is interested in using museums as public forums. And she's been on the show before, so welcome back, Aaliyah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, yeah, thank you for having me, you guys.
Awesome. And we have someone new to the show tonight. We have John Vick, who is a project assistant curator at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. He's worked there for 7 years. His main focus is the permanent collection of modern American and European art. He has organized a number of special exhibitions at the museum. Most recently, he co-curated, along with Dr. Gwendolyn Dubois Shaw of the University of Pennsylvania, the exhibition Represent 200 Years of African American Art, which I had the pleasure to not just see, but also have a tour with John. So, John, thanks so much for being here. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
My absolute pleasure.
Fantastic. So I'm going to actually start with you, John. Talk to me a little about what came about in terms of putting Represent together. When was the idea formed, and why did the Philadelphia Museum of Art decide to put together this retrospective of their collection of African-American art?
Sure. The museum has a very historic and sizable collection of work by African-American artists. This is something that we've known for quite a long time. It is, in many ways, a collection as well that's dispersed across different parts of the museum, because you have artists from an early period in American history, you have artists from the modern era, the early 20th century, which is really sort of my focus, you have contemporary artists who are still living today, and then at our museum, similar to some other major museums across the country, there are also departments that are divided by works on paper and costumes and textiles. So a variety of different departments, each with their own groups of curators who represent these larger collections. But these collections do have a lot of things in common. And one of the commonalities they share is this grouping of work by African American artists. In addition to these different curatorial departments, there's also a really important committee at the museum called the African American Collections Committee, which is made up of staff and the executive members like the director, Timothy Robb, and supporters and trustees and so forth. And actually, this is an organization that was started in 2001 by a woman named Dr. Constance Clayton, who is a former superintendent of public schools. But I'm digressing a little bit. Through this committee, through the different curatorial departments, we decided several years ago to put together a major catalog that would chronicle these important holdings and works. And Dr. Shaw, who's a colleague at the University of Pennsylvania and who's a member of this African American Collections Committee, she was chosen to write for the book. And she was a great author. She's someone who's written on colonial art up to contemporary art. She is really well versed in this long time period, actually more than 200 years. And then she and I worked together to organize and curate the exhibition, drawing from what the museum has to offer, which really is you know, several hundreds of works. What the exhibition ended up being was about 75 works, real important highlights by 50 different artists. And it actually just closed last Sunday on the 5th. I think that last day we had record numbers, more people visited on that final day than any other day, which often happens. But it was a really wonderful exhibition that we were proud to present, and you know, thousands and thousands of people came out to see it.
Yeah, you know, for me, I actually went through this space twice. I went through it on my own with my husband, and it was, you know, it really was a great exhibition. And the thing that struck me the first time I went through it was knowing that these pieces of art were, for the most part, able to be seen around the rest of the museum. But it's a huge art museum, and there was something really powerful about having them in one place and putting them together and kind of giving some perspective on the history of African American art and what that means to the collection at the Philadelphia Museum. Aaliyah, I want to bring you in just to ask a little bit more about, have you seen this before, and how do you direct people a lot of times when they're going into a museum setting where there isn't something as wonderful as represent there to kind of guide them through interaction with African American art and museum spaces?
Sure. Yeah. I haven't actually had a chance to travel to Philadelphia and see the show, but I've heard great things about it. One of the things that I think can be intimidating for visitors is viewing such an expansive space without having a lot of interpretation. So I always encourage people to read a little bit before they go to the museum, or perhaps pick a couple of pieces out that speak to them, that they find aesthetically that they like, or that they question, and, you know, look it up a little later or ask people about it. So I think that's kind of the beginning of fully understanding art, and it's also a process. Mm. You know, you're not going to pick up on everything the first time you get to see a show, especially if you're not accustomed to going. But I always encourage people to find, you know, a couple of pieces that really speak to them, and do a little investigating and find out why. So,
absolutely. Yeah. So the second,
I think you're.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
I think you're. I wanted to say, I think you're really right, Aaliyah. I mean, that's obviously the mentality when we do tours. You know, when you do a tour, you don't go and talk about everything, but you talk about maybe five or six things in depth, and maybe you answer questions about some other things that people ask. I also always think that even as a museum professional, you know, someone who studied art history in school and someone who works in a museum now, I consider a successful visit to a museum if I walk away with one work that is really memorable and really profoundly affects me in a way that I hadn't expected. If that happens with just one work,
exactly.
You know, I think that alone is worth it.
Hmm.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I go to a lot of museums. It's a hobby of mine. I actually was at the Franklin Institute today with my two nieces, so my feet are hurting from walking around there. But I was lucky enough on the second visit to see represent. John actually led the tour that I was on, which is how we met. And there were quite a few things that I was struck by in having this second time going through it. One, I didn't feel like I needed to see every little thing because they had already seen the exhibit itself. So that's one thing I'd recommend as well. If you're going to take a tour, it's nice to kind of give yourself the lay of the land prior to the tour actually happening, because it allows you to really focus on what the tour guide's saying. But the other thing that struck me was the choices that you and Gwendolyn had to make in laying out the exhibition itself. One was that you took a temporal approach, so that we were going through kind of the eras of African-American art. And I wanted to have you tell a little bit about Annunciation and the history of the painting itself. Obviously, the artist and how it ended up at the Philadelphia Museum. It's the first African-American art piece that was purchased by the Philadelphia Museum of Art. So, John, if you don't mind just sharing a little bit with our listeners about that.
Yeah, I would love to. You know, an exhibition like this where you draw from the collection, you're sort of engaging two different types of histories. You're engaging the history of when the works were made, but you're also engaging the history of when did these works come into a collection? Mm. When did a museum buy them? Or when were they received as a donation? And then what life do they have as a part of that collection? And we are really fortunate and proud to say that we have a very, very important painting in our collection by Henry Oswald Tanner called The Annunciation, painted in 1898 when Tanner was in Paris, shortly after he visited the Middle East, a trip he did so that he could better inform his paintings of religious subjects, make them more authentic and realistic. And he made that painting. It was exhibited that same year in 1898 in Paris. And the very next year in 1899, the Philadelphia Museum of Art purchased it with one of its acquisition funds. And it was a landmark moment for the museum, of course, and it was really the starting point of this collection that has now grown exponentially, and especially over the last several decades. But it was actually an important moment in hindsight. I can't imagine it would have been written about at the time. But looking back, we can now recognize that this was the first work by an African-American artist to enter any major public collection in this country. And that's important. I think I said this when we did the tour. I don't want to give the false impression that the Philadelphia Museum of Art was then consistently collecting work by African-American artists from that point in 1899 all the way up to where we are now in 2015. Mm-hmm. You know, it came in fits and spurts. You know, the early 1900s, 19-teens, and then the 1920s, we went through a long building project where our building where we currently are now was constructed. More work started to come in during like the WPA and World War II era, works by African-American artists who were part of that government-sponsored program. And then it really picks up steam in the period following the Civil Rights Movement, and then even more so in the late 80s, when our former director, Ann Darnincourt, takes over as director, and then especially in the last decade and a half, since the African American Collections Committee was founded, because you know, one of their goals is really to not just promote the sharing and understanding of work by African American artists in our local community as well as internationally, but also to advance the acquisition of work by African American artists. So we can see different milestones along the way sort of mark when this collection grew and what those important moments were.
One other thing that struck me about it was that you mentioned that this was not just, the first piece by an African-American artist that was purchased or acquired, I should say, by the museum, but that it was one of the first contemporary pieces also acquired by the museum, which I found very interesting to think that this African American was a trailblazer, not just because of his race, and obviously the piece itself is breathtaking and it's really something to be in its presence, but to have acquired it so soon after he painted it. How do you know much about how that came about and why the museum felt so strongly about acquiring it so quickly?
I don't exactly. There might be some correspondence about it. I think my understanding is that Tanner, who was from Pittsburgh but studied in Philadelphia at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, maintained Philadelphia connections.
Gotcha.
I mentioned already that trip he took to the Middle East. That trip was financed by Rodman Wanamaker, who is the son of John Wanamaker, who founded a really important and successful department store based in Philadelphia. And it was people like the Wanamakers and John G. Johnson and other early founders of the Philadelphia Museum of Art and supporters of it. I shouldn't say founders, that's a generation removed, but these people who were in charge of stewarding the collection around 1900, I think kept their eye on the work that he was doing because they were aware of his talent. But if you look at this painting of Tanner's Annunciation, and, you know, for the listeners at home, you know, just look it up on Google and our website will pop up. You can see, I think even if you're not familiar with traditions of how the Virgin Mary has been depicted from the Renaissance to the present, you can understand the drama and what would have been maybe provocative and innovative about it. Because, you know, you're seeing this woman who seems very relatable and very real. You know, she's wearing clothing that's a little rumpled. She's in this very humble setting. It's the antithesis of these depictions of Mary wearing, you know, starchy clothes and surrounded by angels and in a frame that's gold, and or not a frame that's gold, rather, because actually that frame is gold, but, you know, that her surrounding is heavenly and golden. And she's also, another important point of contrast is that, you know, she's not being shown as this older, pale European woman, but she's being shown as someone who's of Middle Eastern descent, and also someone who's, you know, really very young. And there's something really radical about that when Tanner makes this painting. There's also something radical about the way he depicts the angel that visits her as this column of light. And when this painting was made and when it came to the museum, it was really just the second work by a contemporary artist in our collection. The other work was by James Abbott McNeil Whistler, another really important artist of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And you know, that's because the Philadelphia Museum of Art, like many, was originally focused just on the past and not so much on the present, but you know, eventually started to collect contemporary art. If you look specifically, though, at the collection of work by African-American artists, you see that the precedent set by Tanner's Annunciation is followed, because the rest of the work that is being collected in the early 20th century and really up into the 1970s and 80s is always by contemporary artists. So you could jump to the 30s and you have someone like Samuel Brown, who is an artist who is working with the WPA, and a self-portrait that he made in 1934, the museum then acquires in 1934. And it's a beautiful self-portrait, and actually the first self-portrait of any American artist in our collection. And it just so happens to be an artist of color.
Yeah.
And then you can fast forward to, let's say, 1969, Barclay Hendricks paints Miss T, which is this really spectacular portrait of a young African-American woman wearing this black outfit, and she's got a little gold chain across the front that just shimmers, these sort of rosy glasses and an afro. It's an amazing, beautiful painting. And that was painted in 1969, and the next year, the museum purchases it. You have this happening again with someone, you know, with a variety of other artists, and then coming up to the present. But what's unique is that it actually, in some ways, and I think this reflects the way that scholarship about African American art has changed over time and changed for the better, is that it's in the 1980s that you see a certain revision of the museum's own collection and a realization that although we do have these great works by artists like Tanner, Brown, Hendrix, and others, a realization that there's also artists from generations before who maybe got left out of the writing of history, or who were maybe overlooked by critics, collectors, historians, and so forth. So in the 1980s, we acquire a large chest-on-chest by a furniture maker who was African-American, free. He operated his own shop in the early 1800s in Philadelphia, and he was an established furniture maker. His name's Thomas Gross. And then other works since the 1980s have come in an attempt to sort of fill in the gaps of our collection. So that we're focused not only on contemporary art that's being made by people today, you know, the way we might be looking to someone like, say, Kara Walker, right? But also to artists of generations before. And as with any part of our collection, there's still a lot of work to be done to fill out the story in as rich and meaningful way as possible. You know, coming into the museum at a time that I have, it's very good to know that a lot of this work is already underway and that, you know, I'm now, you know, at my point in my career, at my age, coming into and becoming a part of it as well.
Awesome.
Well, John, I had a quick question for you.
Yeah, please.
Was the switch to contemporary art, was it something that was fueled by just a cultural thing? Was it at the owners of the collections just whim? I mean, what caused that overall shift to just go towards more contemporary art?
Ricky, let me answer your question. So it's the question was, when did, you know, why would the museum start looking to contemporary art and collecting it and including an artist like Tanner? And I think it probably had to do with the taste of the curators, but also a sense of, you know, the museum was founded in 1876, so now the museum's been around 25 years. Maybe there was a renewed sense of courage to start to acquire work by artists who maybe were not yet part of history, but who could become a part of history through a greater recognition and appreciation and awareness among the public, right? Because it's very easy
to generally just, that'd be cheaper too, right?
It is, yeah. But it's from a financial point of view, it's also less certain. I mean, it's easy to justify acquiring a work by, you know, someone like Michelangelo. No one's going to question that he was an important artist during the Renaissance. But you know, if it's 1899 and someone tells you that there's this artist, Henry Tanner, who's living in Paris, but he's actually from the United States and he's very, very good and he makes these great paintings, you might be enthralled and captivated by the painting, but if you're looking at it from a historical point of view, it might be difficult to see how he fits into history because history's still being written at this point. You know, and that's one of the things that, you know, that's one of the things that museums, I suppose, need to realize they are part of, is, and I think they do, is not only aren't they a place where history is preserved, but it's also a place where history in many ways can be written, because at an art museum, the type of work that you show becomes part of people's understanding of a larger cultural production, and it just weaves its way into the way work gets discussed, seen, and understood and known. You know, it's sort of maybe I'm starting to trail off here a little bit, but
I mean it makes perfect sense because
totally. Yeah,
I mean, just for me personally, going to the Getty Museum, not only is the museum itself a work of art, but the works of art there, some are contemporary, some are more classic. And it, you know, it really is kind of subjective.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, it really is. And sometimes it's just about what happens over a course of time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually, that was one of the wonderful things about working on the Represent exhibition, is that it did span so much time that you could see artists like Henry Tanner, but you could also see artists from even before Tanner who were working 100 years or so before, like Moses Williams, who was a silhouette cutter in Philadelphia.
So I was just going to mention him. It's silhouette. So funny.
Yeah. Williams was born into slavery. At a young age, he and his family came to the household of Charles Wilson Peale, who was a early American artist and also founder of, really in some ways, the first American museum, not just art museum, but also science museum, Museum of Natural History. And Williams was trained accordingly, not just in the art of silhouette cutting, but also in the science of taxidermy, right? And in his late 20s, around 27 or 28, Charles Wilson Peale freed Williams, and Williams stayed there, employed, continuing to cut silhouette. So you can see, you know, that's actually was the first work, really, once you walked into the body of the show, were these silhouettes, which showed in this sort of oddly emotional way, because it's a relationship that one can't quite fathom, images of Charles Wilson Peale, who had been the artist's owner, and other members of Peale's family. So you start there, and then you progress through time. You see Tanner, you see artists of the Harlem Renaissance, you see artists who are working in abstraction during the 1960s and 70s, and you come up into the 90s when you look at artists who are making work that sort of begins to recycle history and look back on time. You know, these are artists working during the 90s and the culture wars, and they're trying to make profound statements about the situation of race in this country. And you come eventually to someone who's working in the 2000s and since, like Kara Walker, and suddenly you see these silhouettes again. And the silhouettes, often on white walls that Kara Walker is very well known for. But in our case, on a series of six prints done in 2010 called, I hope I get this right, an unpeopled, oh God, this is unfortunate, but I can't quite remember the exact title. An unpeopled land in uncharted waters. And you see these silhouettes again, and you're reminded of the silhouettes that Moses Williams cut 200 years before. But you also can see a sense of contrast by how those are sort of a very conservative portrayal of individuals, whereas what Kara Walker is doing is trying to make really incisive and critical and thoughtful images that are meant to tell some sort of story about the slave trade across the Atlantic, about encounter, about transportation, forced transportation, about death, about violence, and so forth. And to work on a show where you're dealing with someone like Williams, who is really a historic figure, and then someone like Kara Walker, who is, you know, halfway through working on the project, she had her major installation in Brooklyn. And, you know, she's continuing her career. Her career changes every day, and parts of her life and her career are always changing. So, you know, the exhibition, I think, was meant to reflect that there are artists who are still doing work. And basically that this genre, if we can even call it that, of African-American art, is not only diverse and nuanced and historic, but also it's something that is, you know, still evolving, and it's still developing and still growing as artists continue to work. Similarly, I think if you were to do another show about you know, if you were to do another show like this, even at the same museum in Philadelphia 5 years from now, it would have a different feel to it because, mm-hmm. you know, history mm-hmm. continues to march on, and the way we interpret art and the way we look at art continues to change and continues to alter as we ourselves, you know.
Change. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, experience different things.
Yeah. Aaliyah, I wanted to bring you back in because one thing that also that John mentioned about the Annunciation was this idea of the artist traveling back or traveling to the Middle East to gain some perspective on how, and this is, I always want to make sure I get the artist's name correctly, which is Henry Asawa Tanner. Is that right? Am I saying it correctly? Yes, I am. Traveling to the Middle East to depict Mary in this moment more effectively. And it struck me because we talk a lot, and part of the museum's response to Ferguson is about reclaiming the narrative of what it means to be a Black person in this country and beyond. It struck me that here as an artist, you know, a century ago, doing that very thing with his art. And it's one of those narratives that you don't hear. I think it's great that John pointed out that, you know, once they started looking at the collection, at some point they had to say, well, we need to go further back than what we do have because there's additional stories to be told. And this notion that African-American art didn't exist prior to X date, which is obviously not correct at all. So I'll ask you, Aaliyah, just kind of what your thoughts are about, you know, artists who in their contemporary time were already pushing this idea of reclaiming the narrative and shaping through their art what the vision is for these different portrayals of people of color, you know, as Mary would have been of Middle Eastern descent, given where the things in the Bible were depicted. So I'll just ask you to talk a little bit about that and if you see a lot of museums highlighting those things.
Well, yeah, first I have to say that I agree with John about Tanner's portrayal of Mary in Annunciation. It's a very radical portrayal. And it's also more radical when you think about that he made this in 1890, which is just a little over 30 years removed from the Civil War. So, you know, you're not that far removed from, or even you're not that far removed from Black people would it legally not classified as citizens, let alone Black and brown people having the potential to be portrayed aesthetically as someone carrying Christ. So when you think about it in that terms, it's a very radical thing that he did. One of the contemporary artists that I think about that really pushes the boundaries about Blackness right now is Kehinde Wiley. When you look at his work, he kind of superimposes contemporary Black people onto classic paintings and portraiture. And in a sense, he's showing that Black people are worth being depicted and portrayed or projected into classical paintings. So that really pushes the boundary on how we see and aestheticize Blackness. And I think it's quite amazing. So he would probably be the contemporary artist that I look at right now that I see really pushing the boundaries about how we view Black aesthetics and what we think they're worthy of.
Absolutely.
I think what's, if I can add to, I think what's interesting about Wiley's work is that it also implies a certain critique of, or loaded in his paintings is a certain, he's not just sort of like borrowing imagery or formats from art history, but he's doing it in this sort of like critical way that points out what had been a real, you know, overarching European male whiteness of all those other subjects.
The other thing I wanted to touch on a little bit before you leave us, John, because I know we didn't want to take up too much of your time. But one of the one of the other things that struck me from the collection was this mixture of traditionally trained and not traditionally trained artists within the collection. I think that it really struck me, especially on for those who weren't able to see it or haven't done any research on it, there was one entire wall in the exhibition that was all portraits, and it was a mixture of all different mediums, all different from contemporary to more modern, and just a mixture of different ways of approaching portraiture. And it really struck me to see those depictions up there. How did the choice come for you to make sure that non-traditionally trained artists were included, and how not just did they get acquired, but where did you see them fitting in when you started thinking about what to put and actually display in this collection? Because you obviously had a pretty much wider berth of things to choose from than you were able to put on display in the space.
Yeah, that's a great question. We have a very good collection of work by artists who were self-taught or who were maybe working outside the mainstream art world during their own lifetime. And these artists are from, many of them are American, from all across the country. They're not all African American. Many of them are white. But of this group, there are many that are African American. And I would mention people like Horace Pippin or Bill Traylor, William Edmondson, and there's others too, of course. Those are just three that come to mind. And there was actually, there's so much of this work, and it's such an interesting and compelling history that Gwendolyn Du Bois Shaw, who I mentioned before as the co-curator of the exhibition, but who was also the chief author and editor of the related catalog, she decided that she would dedicate an entire chapter of her book to this history of self-taught outsider artists. So this chapter is mixed in with a chapter that's about decorative art, a chapter about art of the early 20th century, and a chapter about contemporary art since the civil rights. And looking at art by self-taught or outsider artists is on its own sort of very interesting, and it's an interesting field of study because the work is very beautiful and moving. It's oftentimes very much rooted in personal experience. Sometimes these artists have been drawn to making art after a career doing something entirely different, and maybe that compulsion was personal, or maybe it was spiritual. Maybe they believed they were compelled to do that by God. But the history of artists who were self-taught becomes even more interesting when you start to think about what is another more tragic history, which is the way that African Americans had been excluded for so long from access to education and other opportunities. So it's an instance where you see this one important aspect of American history that, broadly affected a huge population of people simply by nature of the color of their skin and the prejudice laws that determined access to education. You see that alongside what it might have meant to be someone who wanted to learn how to paint or sculpt or have access to arts education, and maybe never did, but at some point in their life, they were nonetheless drawn to that creative impulse. It's one of those ways that you just sort of see the history of art overlapping with broader cultural histories and political histories. And, of course, it's united by the power and the strength of the work itself, which is very moving, but can also be very beautiful and lively and fun. and spans really, you know, generations and generations. You know, when it came time to put the work in the exhibition, we wanted to situate these artists in a way that really just put them in the same context as other artists from the same time when they were living. The sort of long history that you can recount in a book sometimes doesn't always translate to an exhibition because, you know, you don't really have as much time to capture someone's attention to explain things in the way you would in a book. So we thought that it would be important to put these artists more side by side and not necessarily prejudice them one way or the other, depending on whether or not they had education. And I think that really was most fully realized at the very end of the show in this portrait section you mentioned, where we really had an opportunity to compare and contrast artists from all across different time periods who were working in a variety of different styles and, to your point, who had formal training, but others who did not.
One of the non-traditionally trained artists that really struck me in the exhibition was Horace Pippin. He was a non-traditionally trained artist. Is that correct? I just want to make sure I'm right in that assumption.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. His work struck me because, you know, he was coming back from war, nursing wounds, came back to Westchester, Pennsylvania, where he was from. And you could really feel the therapy in the art that he was doing. There was a sense of, you know, having to get this out in some artistic fashion, and it almost not being a choice on his part. You know, it was something that had to come out, had to be expressed, had to come forth from him, whether training was there or not. The desire and the skill were both matched up in that moment and able to bring forth some amazing pieces. Aaliyah, I would turn back to you again just to ask. I think that's one of the things I've seen when I look at a lot of the chats you guys have been doing with. I don't know if, John, if you know, but there's been a monthly hashtag Museums Respond to Ferguson chat that's been happening on Twitter every month, where a lot of museum professionals have been just getting together. And actually, I'll let Aaliyah talk to you. Just start with just talking about what that is, Aaliyah, first, and then if you could just address that question or that comment that I made about, you know, the way that art comes forth from non-traditionally trained artists as sort of a therapy and sometimes a larger statement about what's going on in their lives at that moment. So I'll turn it over to you, Aaliyah, for that.
Sure. Okay. So Museums Respond to Ferguson is a monthly Twitter chat, and it happens the third Wednesday of every month. And we usually pick a theme, and we kind of dissect how that goes back to Ferguson. And when we say Ferguson, originally we were referring to, you know, the instance that happened in Ferguson with Mike Brown, but now it's more broadly oppression and anti-blackness. So what we're really dealing with is dissecting how museums perpetuate oppression and anti-blackness. So in a nutshell, that's kind of what the chat is. And it was born out of the joint statement that several museum bloggers, including myself, released. Gretchen Jennings was the one that kind of led the movement in producing that document about museums needing to respond to Ferguson. So that's what that's kind of how the Twitter chat was born, since we wanted to continue that discussion. And then in terms of art produced by non-traditional people, this is actually kind of dealing with my dissertation. I'm looking at quilt makers and how they've interpreted history. So I think that's one of the really important aspects of non-traditional or outsider art, is that oftentimes they are documenting history or documenting important things in their lives, and their art is a platform to them that they normally wouldn't have other places. So they don't have the social standing to maybe express themselves other ways. They may not necessarily have the political enfranchisement to express themselves. But we see, in one person that I'm thinking about in particular, Quilter, is Harriet Powers. She was formerly enslaved, but yet through her extant quilts, we kind of see what her day was like through the pictures that she quilted, as well as what was important to her, like her favorite Bible stories. So art is definitely a platform for people who don't necessarily have a voice, whether that's through social circumstances, economic, gender-related, or political.
Awesome.
Yeah, and actually thinking, you know, about Pippin, you get a sense of his experience serving in the First World War. But you also see him gain confidence over time. Mm-hmm. We had this early painting that's just about the drama of the battlefield from around 1933. We had that hanging on a wall, and next to it was a painting from 10 years later that was called Mr. Prejudice. And that was a painting that was explicitly about the inequality or the problem of segregation in the military. And of course, segregation in the military was part of that first painting about his experience in the First World War, because it showed an all-black regiment that he was a part of. But it wasn't center stage. It was just sort of implicit. And to see an artist sort of gain confidence through their work and sort of achieve that platform that you were talking about, creative enfranchisement, we might say, really comes through in that later work, Mr. Prejudice, because it's really bold and it's really daring. And it's done in 1943 when we're, in the middle of a Second World War, and the notion of saying anything anti-American or opposed to, victory on the battlefront, would have been seen as questionable. So, you're really right, Aaliyah, the way that art can allow people an opportunity to say things that they maybe couldn't have found a way to say in other words.
Awesome.
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. So my final question for you, John, before you leave us is just, kind of what is there any idea or plans around making almost an African-American art tour of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, or taking these pieces so that people can kind of go through the other areas of the museum that that they currently would reside, whether it be modern art or textile art or whatever it is, so that they can still see them in the context that you so lovingly put them together, even though they won't have that space together at the same time. Kind of where does it live moving forward from here? Represent?
Well, the catalog, of course, still exists. So for people who want that real scholarly point of access, that book will always be there, either, to buy or just to read at our library or at other public libraries. And similarly, we do teacher resource packets for teachers, and that packet that we make available to public school teachers and private school teachers, too, that remains relevant because this is all work from our collection. But when it comes to actually seeing the real works in person, we knew it was important when the show closed to put or to do what we could to keep the work on view by putting it back into other parts of the permanent collection gallery. And the priorities for us when the show closed were, of course, Tanner's Annunciation, the large storage jar by David Drake,
which is amazing.
And just another amazing thing.
Amazing.
And, a testament to the collection that, another amazing thing that I haven't even mentioned yet. Barclay Hendrix, Miss T, we put these things up actually on Monday, the day after the show closed, when the museum was closed to the public, so that when people would come back on Tuesday, they would be back up. But that's not really enough. We need to, there's other works in the collection that were in the show that we want to put back up. There are these two beautiful landscape paintings by William Henry Johnson. One of them was in the show, but another one wasn't. And I have plans to put them on view in our modern European wing, because they were paintings he made while he was in France. And I think finding ways to remix the context of these works so that you can, you know, you can appreciate the way they're being shown in this big history of African American art he represents. But, you know, there's a lot to be gained by seeing someone like William Henry Johnson in the context of European art, because that's how he lived for 15 years when he was in Europe, in France, and in Scandinavia. And I think continually renewing the way we present this work, but also making sure we really do present it, that it stays on view, is important moving forward. And then in terms, to answer your question about a tour, I know we're really actively looking at ways to improve sort of what is the behind the scenes of our database, because it's the behind the scenes of our database that feeds into, you know, sort of like the metadata of our collection catalog that's available to the public. And if that's more dynamic in terms of search functions and so forth, then, and if we can pair that with new technology in the galleries that maybe engage wayfinding, so that if you have a phone, you can just sort of find your way through the museum and find work by, you know, abstract artists or self-taught artists or female artists or African-American artists or, you know, artists who are using plywood or whatever else you want to do, there should be ways using technology to make that possible. Mm.
Yeah, it's not not impossible. You just have to have a lot of – you either have to have an app that allowed for GPS access, or you could use wireless routers throughout the museum.
Right, and I think we're working on ways to combine that with someone in our interpretation department. So, that's the near future. The long future is that the museum's trying to expand its interior footprint and add more gallery spaces. When we do that, we'll have new opportunities to show areas of the collection that don't have enough room right now, and that includes contemporary art, modern art, and American art, areas that all are essential to, you know, the represent collection of African-American artists. So by the time that comes around, and, you know, assuming we're all still alive, there will be more opportunity for this work to be shown. But in the meantime, we want to sort of improve the presentation of these artists throughout the entire museum so that it's not just Henry Kanner and David Drake, but then it's also many of the other artists that we have represented.
Absolutely. Well, again, John, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. I really appreciate
it. It was a pleasure.
I really wanted it was such a unique collection. I hadn't gone through an exhibit that was quite as comprehensive. And the few that I had gone through were more traveling. And it really was important when I went through it to know that these were pieces of art that had a home here in Philadelphia. And so it really, it meant a lot for me to be able to go through it. And you were such a gracious tour guide to be there. And then take the second part of the tour, where we got to see some murals, which I'll have to do a whole nother show about the Philadelphia mural system.
You should get Jane Golden.
Phone and talk with her as well. But again, thanks so much. Do you want to let people know if they can find you online or on Twitter, or are you in those realms and wanting to connect with people?
Not professionally, but I would recommend that if people are interested in the museum, they can follow us at Phila Museum, on Twitter, on Instagram. We have a Tumblr. We're on Facebook. And the handle is just Phila Museum. I think we were one of the, most favorite art museums on Instagram a year or two ago. We're really proud of what we put up on our feed, and it's really fun images. So for people who are in the area, if you can get out and see some of the exhibitions that we have up now, Represent is closed, but we have an amazing exhibition of Japanese art that's up until May 10th. And, we're always doing all sorts of fun, dynamic, public programs as well. And all the information's on the website. So, I guess that would be what I would consider worth mentioning. So, Leslie, I want to thank you, and Ricky as well, and Aaliyah for joining me in this conversation, too. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
Have a great night.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, guys. Do you guys need to take a break or go to the bathroom or anything? As we're kind of at the hour mark.
I think I'm okay.
You guys are okay? How about you, Ricky?
Give me like 7 minutes. Seven
minutes. That's very specific.
Yeah.
All right. Something I was about to say.
Thanks for letting.
Are we doing any news today?
We are. We're going to get to some news. Aaliyah, do you want to talk about news with us, Aaliyah, or are you? I wanted to just talk a little bit about your most recent museum's respond to Ferguson, and just kind of what came from that conversation and how things are going. And also wanted to talk to you about Black.
I'll step away real quick. I'll be right back.
Okay. And also talk to you about Black Twitter Storians as well. And how that's been going. And it's been so interesting watching all of you guys kind of connect with each other. Had this been something happening prior to, the Black Lives Matter movement? Was it, or were Black historians more isolated? I found this in a lot of other areas too, not just in historian or museum spaces, but you know, in artistic spaces, in writing spaces, in podcasting. There's been this great sense of like, hey, we can connect, we can have a voice, a unified one. We can kind of amplify each other. And so I'm interested to ask you if this was things that were happening prior to you know, the current movement.
No, Black Twitter historian just started that 2 months ago. So one of my colleagues, Joshua Crutchfield at Middle Tennessee State University, we were talking one day, and we were trying to figure out if there was something for Black historians online, and we realized that there was nothing. So we decided to start this chat, and mainly for a lot of the reasons that you said, we're so siloed in this field. You know, there's often one or two Black people in a program at a time. And so we don't really get to connect with each other. We feel isolated. You know, so I think having this online platform is good to for people to not only connect with each other, but to see what works we are doing, and also kind of affirm each other, because, you know, we don't get that in our department.
Right.
You know, so we'll get something published or do an amazing project, and it's kind of underpublicized. Mm-hmm. So one of the other reasons why we created Black Twitter Historians is that so we could kind of publicize our own work, good work that we're doing.
Absolutely. And I think that there's a twofold level of anti-Blackness at work in a lot of these academic spaces. The first is obviously in the product itself. You know, when you're talking about either museum spaces, or you're talking about educational spaces, or you're talking about historical spaces, that there is a general, you know, kind of layer of supremacy and anti-Blackness, as there is with everything in our society. But there's a second, almost more insidious aspect of it, which is that the institutions themselves inflict anti-Blackness on the people that are a part of them. And so I guess I would just ask about, you know, how you come to do the work in such an environment, because you're kind of working against two systems. One, you're trying to tell a story nobody wants to be told. And then secondarily, you're working in most cases in an environment that doesn't even want to hear your voice. And how you navigate that must be challenging, to say the least. And kind of what tools have come to pass, or if you had a wish list of what tools you would want to have to help do that, you know, what would they be?
Yeah, you're right. It's challenging. So there are a couple of things that I have figured out along the way, and that I tell other Black academics. One is to find allies. So you have all to right, connect with people. Hello.
Hey, Ricky.
We're talking about Black Twitter historians. So I was just telling Leslie that in order to kind of navigate the academic world, which often perpetuates anti-Blackness, is to find allies. Mm-hmm. You have to find people that kind of agree with your vision or see that there's value in your work. You have to connect with other Black people, whether that they're actually in your program or not. And that's also why it's important to go to conferences. One of the major conferences in our field is the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. And we always laugh because it's almost like a family reunion. That's like the one time where all the Black people are together. I remember last year I went, I don't even remember what the presentation was on. All I know is that there was a Too Short reference and everyone in the crowd got it. Like we were all laughing. And I was thinking, this is the only place that that could happen, you know, because if it was at any one of our other home institutions and we said something like that, it would have went over their heads. Like, they would have never realized what just happened. So,
that's so true.
I'd say, you know, it's just important to really relish those moments where you are around other Black people who appreciate your work and who are kind of willing to help you get better and to support you.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you don't understand the Too Short reference, like you need to see what's gone wrong with your life.
I was gonna say you're not living the right life. Your life is not right. You need to get right. Get yourself together.
And I was thinking, oh man, that would have just been such a good reference going to waste. And you know that happens all the time. Like I'll be thinking some rap lyric, and it totally relates to what we're talking about, but I know they wouldn't get it. So.
Of course. Yeah, it's so true. And I also wonder, you know, this concept of diversity, which I actually hate, but this concept of diversity in a lot of these academic spaces is interesting because I feel like we've had a couple of decades of push of the idea of diversity and it being a numbers game and that being what diversity is versus the product being what should be the focus on. Like, you know, not to say that I don't, of course I value Blackness and Black people in all academic spaces, but if there were a way for a white academic space to actually produce non-anti-Black, you know, product, I'd be pretty happy with that too. So, it's interesting that it's so much about that. It's like, well, we need to have X amount of people of color. We need to have X amount of women. We need to have X amount.
Yeah.
It's a very, it's very strange.
I really agree with you. I have come to despise the term diversity and mainly, I remember in my program, I had mentioned that in our program review that we needed to recruit more Black graduate students. And one of the alumni mentioned the first and only Black person to ever graduate from this program. And she's like, well, we have her. She graduated. And I'm like, that's one person out of the oldest, one of the oldest programs in the United States for this field. And you're like, referencing one person and proud of that. That's a problem. So, but just goes back to what you're saying, how diversity is problematic when it's a numbers game. It's also problematic when it becomes a paternalistic thing. Mm. Like, where, and I've seen that a lot, where it's like, oh, we have to get these poor Black people in here and help them out and whatever we can do for them. You know, like
I'd be cool with that, to be honest, if there was the admission that there's a reason. We have to get these poor Black people. We have to help them. You know why? Because we've been fucking them over for the past 450 years. Like, if that was the understanding, I would be okay with that type of logic, but it never is.
Yeah, I think we have to kind of make that distinction. Logic, because it ultimately comes back to they feel that there's some type of inferiority, so they have to
compensate
in a special way.
Yeah.
And, you know,
but there is, and it's artificial.
That
it's man-made.
That definitely, it downplays my work. I'm not an intellectually inferior. I don't produce intellectually inferior scholarship. So I don't want to be seen as needing your help.
Right.
So that's the way that I viewed it. And, you know, it would be different if it was like, you know, these are a group of people who have not received the same type of resources and advantages. That's quite different than saying these people are just not competent, but
we're going to let them anyways.
Like, to seem like we're good people, we're going to give them
I'll put quotes around the good people part. Yeah,
but to be honest, to the extent that it is true that there is an incompetency in any particular field, it's because it's artificial. It's not natural.
Right, it's not an incompetency in skill. That's the thing. It's an incompetency in access, and that's where the distinction needs to be made.
An opportunity
Right. And I think it's why obviously John's gone now, but it was why I was so struck by this Represent exhibition, because you know these pieces already had homes in the whole rest of the museum. You know it. And it was astounding to me to be like, you pulled all of this from this museum here in Philadelphia, all of these amazing African-American artists who spend centuries in this country of making the most beautiful pieces of art, you know, that represented themselves, their time, history, artistic endeavor, generally speaking. And they were just, you know, with their contemporaries around the museum. I think it's great on one hand because they should be seen as contemporaries of their peers. But at the other side of that, there should be some dispensation to put in context the circumstances under which this art was actually created, because it's not the same as their peers. And, you know, it really was able to make that point very clear. Like, yeah, these people were doing the same fucking thing that all those people that were doing it at the same time were doing, it except for nobody was paying them. They had no way of making a living doing it. And oh yeah, that's right, they were owned by somebody. I mean, this is it's mind-boggling when you think of still pursuing artistic endeavor under those circumstances. It speaks so much to, you know, the heart of an artist and the draw and the drive that you have to have artistic vision, that you have to have it seen, you have to let it out. And too often Black artists, and this is not just in the visual arts, but in music and lots of other areas when artistic endeavor comes to mind, that is downplayed. The hardships that have to be endured in order to just be an artist. You know, it's not impressive to me that some, you know, aristocratic, rich son was able to paint an amazing painting in 1853. He should. He has every tool at his disposal to be able to do that. But if you tell me a Black person did that same thing, now I'm impressed, because I know all of the things that went into and all of the obstacles that had to be overcome in order for that to come to pass. The least of which is their own perseverance as a person. And then you talk about all of the other things that come into play. So it's one of the things I've really liked about the museum's Respond to Ferguson, is that you guys have been able to put these works into context, to put these spaces into context, and to allow people to think about them differently, which is great.
Well, I think providing context is a really big
thing.
Go ahead, Aaliyah, and then Ricky will talk after that.
Okay. Something else that I'd like to add to the conversation about Black art is I think the thing that struck me most when I worked at the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center is that by and large it's a history museum, but we had a sizable art collection. And the reason why we had a sizable art collection and a history museum was because museums were not, at the time, not collecting Black art. So we have a lot of protest art. We have a few, they have a few nationally recognized names like Elizabeth Catlett and people of her stature, but there were also a lot of regional Midwestern artists that museums were just not collecting their art because they didn't collect black art, especially not protest art from the 1960s. So I always found it amazing that they continued to make art even though people were not acknowledging it and certainly not paying for it. And then having to, I mean, yeah, it's a great honor to have your work in the permanent collection of the National Afro-American Museum, but I'm sure they were wondering if their work would ever get into an art museum.
Right.
I think that's something else to consider.
Yeah, and the fact that there has to be an African-American art museum is part of the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, that we're not even able to provide that kind of context outside of an African-American museum. You know, if each of those pieces in their own separate areas were able to tell the story of the artists' lives, and, you know, I think we'd be able to look at things a lot differently. Mm. It just because even the little bit, the slightest surprise that human beings, in this case black people, but human beings can't produce art under duress. Almost it makes us seem inhuman. Not human at all, because art is an expression of life, regardless of where you are in your life. But at that time that you create that piece, that is an expression of your life, generally speaking. It just boggles me that we actually have to come from this perspective because this is what we're taught. But as a human being, if you're an artist, you're an artist, and you're going to be one regardless of where you are in life. It's just a shame that we didn't get the opportunities that other artists did.
Right. Absolutely. For sure. I didn't have too much more for you, Ali. I just wanted to make sure that we talked a little bit about the context of the That Represent piece of exhibition, because it really was revelatory to me. And actually, I bought the book because it was just really, really good and just really great to see. And as I said, you know, I've seen a lot of African-American art exhibitions, but they've been traveling. And so the power of it living here and having a home here in Philadelphia, all of that art was really something to me. And you know, the stories of each of these individuals was really moving to me as well. Do you have a theme for April's museum's Respond to Ferguson yet? And just tell us the date of that and all of that as well, so people know.
We are still working on the theme. So sometimes the themes come to us pretty naturally, sure. And we automatically know what we're going to ask, and sometimes it's a little bit more difficult, and this is one of those times. But Museums Respond to Ferguson for April is April 15th and 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So we encourage everyone to be on the lookout for that. We'll for sure by next week release the theme. And then we also have short blog pieces for people to read to kind of get acquainted with what we're going to ask them about. And actually, one of the links that you included, let me see if I can find it.
The Expose Your Museum. That is that the one you're talking about? I don't know if it is or not.
The Expose Your Museum, and then also Museums and Black Lives Matter by Nick Hill.
Yes.
We've used some of his pieces too. Actually, I think it was for our third conversation. He wrote a piece about oppression, and we asked people to look at how museums kind of perpetuate oppression by internal practices, not hiring black people in leadership roles, and when they do hire them, not giving them the platform to actually make decisions and make policy changes.
You mean like our president?
yeah, exactly. You know, I think I've said this before, you know, you can't just Photoshop me into a position, you know, just for the sake of diversity. I actually have to have the power to go through with what I actually feel needs to happen. So those are some of the things that we addressed. The last time we talked about allyship and what it means to be an ally. Can museums be an ally, and how on the larger level, but on the more interpersonal level, how coworkers can be allies, how they can, you know, stop anti-blackness, and how they can work with black colleagues. So it's been very fulfilling. I think that it's been a useful conversation, and I think people are learning from it. It's going to be a long-term process because we're really unpacking things that people haven't talked about much.
And purposefully.
Especially the ways that museums have kind of facilitated oppression, especially against black and brown people. Mm. We've also talked about solutions. We always try to make sure that it's a solution-based conversation, too, sure. And that we're not just pointing out the flaws, but we're also, you know, making sure that people know that, and I think this came up earlier in the conversation, you know, while we're kind of repositories of history, we're also kind of making history in a sense. So, for example, one of the things that museums can do is make sure that they are collecting information that is relevant to the black experience. Mm. Especially with Ferguson, you know, those materials need to be collected so that 100 years from now,
we know what happened.
People still know.
Yeah.
Right. They have the tactile, the materials that represented that experience. Otherwise, it goes away. And when we don't have materials to represent what happened, it, in a sense, didn't happen. So collections policies about the types of artifacts you collect, educational programming, all of those things are important to kind of counteracting anti-blackness or even silencing of blackness.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, And I had a quick follow-up question. I mean, given the fact that those who perpetuate white supremacy have had a long and very storied history of erasure, particularly in art and in museums, how does one like actually go about doing that and maintaining it?
Well, first, I think this was maybe the second, and I'll send you all the Storify so you can include the link, but I think this was, we talked about this in our second conversation, that museums really need to do a deep internal look at their operations. So, and that's often not what people want to hear. So, right, they'll always ask me, what can I do to be a part of Black Lives Matter? What can I do to help fight racism? And I always tell them to start by looking within and seeing what ways you facilitate oppression. And that's difficult for people. They, you know, they're more willing to chant or write a post or whatever because that doesn't take a lot of internal or uncomfortable work. But I've encouraged individuals as well as museums to look internal. And what does that mean for an organization? It means that they may have to hire a consultant to kind of take them through that journey about looking through their policies, looking at their staff. Does their staff actually represent the public? And most of the time, that's not the case. Most of the time, I think I read in the Alliance for American Museums that the current overall staff for museums is like 80% white, maybe a little bit more. But that's definitely not reflective of our current population. And why is that? You know, there are plenty of Black people who are pursuing advanced degrees and getting experiences in museums. So why aren't they being hired? And why don't they have a voice? Why, looking at collections policies, why are you eager to collect something that does not have to do with Blackness? Looking at programs, why are you eager not to talk about race? This has came up in a couple of the chats where people said their employers specifically told them that they should divert from race if it came up in a public program.
Wow.
So, you know, I think before people can go out and externally do this type of work, they need to look internally and see if their policies and their actions actually reflect what they're saying. And it takes a while. It's a journey. And I think one of the things that we can look at is that recent Starbucks campaign. And one of the reasons why I think that it failed is because it seemed so ingenuous.
Yeah.
What is a barista going to tell me about race? Like, did they get training to talk about race? Did they, you know, what pedigree do they have to talk about and kind of mediate these difficult conversations? And
Aaliyah, you know, white people know racism better than anyone else, remember?
but they don't know that. You know, that's what I'm finding. Because they've never had to actually think about it that way, like that their lives, what they're doing is racist or perpetuating anti-Blackness. And that's why the one chat that we talked about oppression, it lasted a while because I think people never realized that certain actions that they were taking, because they never had to think about it, they were actually racist. When they actually made a decision not to collect certain Black materials, I think the light bulb finally went off in their head, like, oh, that's not cool. We should have been collecting Black materials. So you're absolutely right. They do know racism more than anyone, but if they actually could identify that or acknowledge that, is a different story.
Absolutely. I was being sarcastic.
Of course.
I think they can point it out once they understand what racism is, but a lot of white people don't even understand racism.
And I think
get to a point where they see it.
And I think that the concepts that you're talking about are, they ricochet to so many other areas. I mean, the nonprofit sector is one that I really, you know, have increasingly become so frustrated with regard to an inability to confront the anti-Blackness that goes on within their organizations. And it's like, you can't be taken seriously coming to the table to discuss Black Lives Matter, to discuss Ferguson, to discuss with activists that are working towards Black liberation when you are actively oppressing Black people that work for you, that work with you. And it just is so disingenuous, and it just smacks of, you know, we're only willing to discuss things when it doesn't mean we have to do anything with our shit. And it's just fucking tired and stupid, and it doesn't make any sense, and it does no good. And that is one more signal that I know how different the Black Lives Matter movement is from previous pushes for civil rights, is that no, we're not going to allow it to be about laws only. We're not going to only have it be about rules only. We are talking about trying to create a systemic and societal shift in our entire thinking process. And that means that every organization has to look at itself, every school, every religion, every congregation, every museum.
Because that's how laws happen.
That's what has to happen.
Come along.
Exactly. It's not a, you know, they're putting the cart before the horse, and it's like, we need to discuss some more fundamental things and do this internal work. And I say that about people. I mean, I myself, I posted on Facebook earlier this week, a year ago this week, I wrote and spoke at my own church about this piece that I wrote called The Unintentional Other. And I really had to challenge myself. In my religion, we have seven principles that we stand by, but the biggest one and the first one is the belief in the inherent dignity and worth of all people. And I had myself allowed, space in my heart and my head to otherize people, whether they be felons or ex-convicts or lots of things that I might have put on a list of allowing me to say that they weren't as worthy of that same dignity that I was affording myself and others who were more like me. And it was really, the piece itself was really about me coming to terms with that fact and saying like, nope, I got to do this internal work before I can do any outside work, because my work won't be worthy of being done if I'm coming to the table with these same, complete, self-destructive and internally oppressive thought processes coming to the table. And that's what these organizations have to come to terms with. And that's what they need to be looking at. So it's
or at least being able to admit it.
Absolutely. And you have to be able to say like, oh yeah, this is not, shit has not been good here for a while. And the truth is, if you just talk to the black people that work for you, they'll tell you, because it's not something that they don't talk about when they go home at night, when they talk to colleagues in other areas, when they talk to the three other black people they work with. It's not a fucking secret to them that it sucks being the only or a very small portion of a black people in an environment that then devalues your blackness. It sucks. So I love seeing all these conversations happen. And when you say that, like, yeah, when people come up to you and say, what can we do? It's like, yeah, well, there's a lot of work you need to do before you can do anything, quote unquote, because that's how the stuff gets done. You know, it's not a matter of a checklist. It's about you deciding that you're going to do things differently and that you're going to take these things into account when you make decisions. And when you're talking to people and when you're hiring and when you're putting together the work that you're doing. So it's all encompassing.
And I think it's about being a net positive. Like you don't really understand whether or not you can't really assess whether or not you're doing a net positive job. If you don't understand all the factors that go into racism and white supremacy, it's that you're kind of working without enough knowledge, to be honest. You're working blind.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So Aaliyah, tell us again where everybody can find you online so that we can make sure that they're hooking up with you correctly and staying on top. And of course, Ferguson Response fully supports both the Black Twitter Historians live tweet and also, of course, Museums Respond to Ferguson. So you will see that on the Tumblr as we get closer to those dates. But just tell everyone where they can find you and follow you and all that good stuff.
Sure, yeah. You can follow me on Twitter at Aaliyah Brown, and that's AaliyahBrown. I'm also on Facebook, and my name is Aaliyah Brown. But please, I'd say, follow the hashtags and conversations, Black Twitter Historians and Museums Respond to Ferguson on Twitter.
Awesome. Awesome. Thanks so much again for joining us. I really, really appreciate
it.
It's been great talking to you.
Thank you. I always enjoy talking to you all.
I'm sure we'll have you on again soon, because there's always more stuff coming up. And, the spaces that you're working in are so imperative to, changing the narrative on anti-blackness in this country. So I really appreciate all the work that you've been doing. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. Have a great night.
Okay.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So thanks again for joining Ricky and I for this special, or not special, but the new edition of the Ferguson Response Network podcast. It was so great to have both Aaliyah Brown and John Vick on to discuss art and museum spaces and how we can kind of utilize that to change the narrative and really remove anti-blackness and white supremacy from these types of spaces. Again, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Ferguson Response Network. You can also go directly to our website, fergusonresponse.org. And if you are looking for actions or you have actions coming up, go to the newly revised and updated fergusonresponse.tumblr.com. You can find me online on Twitter at Leslie Mack, MAC, and you can find Ricky on Twitter as well at AUADOTORG. Thanks and have a great night.